Dzień dobry. Witam serdecznie. Bardzo.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. We are very happy to see so many of you here. I'd like to welcome you on behalf of the Jewish Culture Festival in Krakow and on behalf of our foundation, the foundation that made it possible for us to present Irena Klepfisch to you today for the first time. She is having meetings with her readers in Poland. So this is a very important moment. And in our meeting, first I will start with introducing Irena to you. Then she will read her poetry for you. And also we have an audio clip for you. And then I would like to talk to Irena about what she writes about in her poetry, and then we will have time for questions from you. Also, I would like to say that we don't have Bożena Kef here with us today. Unfortunately, she was unable to arrive. She fell ill. This is why I'm here with you. My name is Gabi von Seltmann, and I'm happy to be able to talk to Irena today and chair this meeting. Maybe you've had an opportunity to learn something about Irena. I will tell you a few words by way of introduction. These are all adjectives describing Irena, but in fact, it's very difficult to describe well what she does. Irena Klepfisch is a poet, and she's a translator from Yiddish. She teaches at Jewish Women's Studies, and she was born in 1941 in the Warsaw Ghetto. Her dad died soon after her birth. Her dad, Michał Klepfisch, was a member of the Bund movement, and he died on the second day of the ghetto uprising. Then he received the Virtuti Militari Medal. Together with her mother, she went into hiding in the countryside until liberation. Then they moved to Łódź, and in 1946, they emigrated to Sweden, and in 1949 to the U.S., where Irena lives now in New York. Irena Klepfisch is an active member of feminist organizations, lesbian organizations, and secular Jewish organizations, as well as peaceful organizations. She started publishing her poetry in 1971, and she focused in her work on Yiddish authors like Kadia Mlodowski and Fradl Stock. She was a founder of the feminist magazine Conditions, and she was a Yiddish editor of the Jewish feminist magazine Bridges. She is a co-author of The Tribe of Dina, an anthology of Jewish women writers, an author of A Few Words in a Mother Tongue, and a collection of entitled Den Insomniac. And when she taught at Jewish Women's Studies at Bernard College, she also taught for 10 years at a women's prison. Recently, namely last year, she was awarded with the Adrian Cooper Dream Award in Yiddish. Now I'd like to invite Irena to read her poetry. We have 30 minutes now. You will be able to hear Irena, and in your headsets you will be able to hear interpretation into Polish. These poems were translated by Bożena Kef into Polish. The Yiddish words will remain in Yiddish.
Okay, I will tell you. Hi. Dzień dobry. To jest dobrze, tak? Tak, okay. I'm going to start with a Yiddish poem that's not mine, but it's by a Yiddish poet that I greatly admire, Rachel Korn. I don't know whether people have heard of her. She started out, actually, she was writing in Polish, and her first publications were in a Zionist Polish newspaper. And in response to anti-Semitism, she decided to switch to Yiddish. And she became really one of the great Yiddish writer. She survived the war in the Soviet Union, and she ended up in Montreal, Canada, where there was an actually very vibrant Yiddish literary circle and community. And I just want to, I thought it would be really nice to begin with a Yiddish woman poet who came from Poland, and to have that voice heard here again. So this is one of my favorite poems of hers. I'm going to read it in Yiddish, but as I understand it, they're going to translate it for you in Polish so that those of you that don't know Yiddish can also understand it. Von jener Zeit Lied. Von jener Zeit Lied ist ein Sod voran und in Sod ist ein Haus mit einem streuenden Dach. Es stehen drei Sosnes und schweigen sich aus, drei Schomrim auf ständiger Wach. Von jener Zeit Lied ist ein Vogel voran, ein Vogel bräungel mit rötlicher Brust. Er kommt dort zu fliehen jeden Winter aufs Neue und hängt wie ein Knops auf dem nackten Kust. Von jener Zeit Lied ist ein Steschke voran, a so schmal und scharf wie der dünnster Schnitt. Und Emmet, was hat sich verblondet in Zeit, geht dort mit Stille und Bolwisse tritt. Von jener Zeit Lied kennen Wunder geschehen, noch heint in der Tag, was ist schmarne und grau, wenn er defekt rein in dem Gloss von der Scheib, die zerfieberte Bänkschaft von der windiger Schau. Von jener Zeit Lied kennen meine Mama Arois und stehen auf der Schwelle, a Weile vertracht, und mir rufen nach heim, wie amol, wie amol. Genug sich gespürt schon, du sehst nicht, es ist Nacht. That was from Rachel Korn. And I'm going to read one more poem that's not my own, and this is a tribute to a friend of mine, a wonderful American Jewish poet, Hannah Block. I don't know how many people know have heard of her work. She died about 3.5 weeks ago. She was created wonderful poetry, and she was also a wonderful translator. She translated Yehuda Amichai with Hannah Kronfeld, and she translated Yiddish poetry and Hebrew poetry. So I just want to read in honor of Hannah, who I met, and I think the first time I met Hannah, I was 16 and she was 17, so it was a long time ago. So this is a poem she wrote, which she loved to read. It has, I think you'll probably know, Baba Yaga, the character Baba Yaga. And she had two young boys, and she used to talk to them about Baba Yaga. So this is a poem when they were very young, and she wrote this poem, and it's called Brothers, from Hannah Block. When I was the Baba Yaga of the house on my terrible chicken legs, the children sat close on the sofa as I read, both of them together determined to be scared. Careful, I cackled, stalking them among the pillows. You bad Russian boy, I eat you up. They shivered and squirmed, my delicious sons, waiting for a mighty arm to seize them. I chased them, screeched down the hall. I catch you, I eat you, my witch blade hungry for the spurt of laughter. What stopped me, even as I lifted my hand? The stricken voice that cried, eat him, eat my brother. That was Hannah Block. Okay, this is my own work. This is from a rather long autobiographical prose poem called Bashert, and it has four sections which pinpoint four different moments in my life in different places. It begins with a dedication, which I'm going to read, and I'm going to read the very first part, which takes place in Poland. Bashert. These words are dedicated to those who died. These words are dedicated to those who died because they had no love and felt alone in the world. because they were afraid to be alone and tried to stick it out, because they could not ask, because they were shunned, because they were sick and their bodies could not resist the disease, because they played it safe, because they had no connections, because they had no faith, because they felt they did not belong and wanted to die. These words are dedicated to those who died because they were loners and liked it, because they acquired friends and drew others to them, because they took risks, because they were stubborn and refused to give up, because they asked for too much. These words are dedicated to those who died because a card was lost and a number was skipped, because a bed was denied, because a place was filled and no other place was left. These words are dedicated to those who died because someone did not follow through, because someone was overworked and forgot, because someone left everything to God, because someone was late, because someone did not arrive at all, and because someone told them to wait and they just couldn't any longer. These words are dedicated to those who died because death is a punishment, because death is a reward, because death is the final rest, because death is eternal rage. These words are dedicated to those who died. Bashert. These words are dedicated to those who survived. These words are dedicated to those who survived because their second grade teacher gave them books, because they did not draw attention to themselves and got lost in the shuffle, because they knew someone who knew someone else who could help them and bumped into them on a corner on a Thursday afternoon, because they played it safe, because they were lucky. These words are dedicated to those who survived because they knew how to cut corners, because they drew attention to themselves and always got picked, because they took risks, because they had no principles and were hard. These words are dedicated to those who survived because they refused to give up and defied statistics, because they had faith and trusted in God, because they expected the worst and were always prepared, because they were angry, because they could ask, because they mooched off others and saved their strength, because they endured humiliation, because they turned the other cheek, because they looked the other way. These words are dedicated to those who survived, because life is a wilderness and they were savage, because life is an awakening and they were alert, because life is a flowering and they blossomed, because life is a struggle and they struggled, because life is a gift and they were free to accept it. These words are dedicated to those who survived. Bashert. Poland, 1944. My mother is walking down a road. My mother is walking down a road somewhere in Poland, walking towards an unnamed town for some kind of permit. She's carrying her Aryan identity papers. She has left me with an old peasant who is willing to say she is my grandmother. She is walking down a road. Her terror in leaving me behind, in risking the separation, is swallowed now, like all other feelings. But as she walks, she pictures me waving from the dusty yard, imagines herself suddenly picked up, the identity papers challenged, and even if she were to survive that, would she ever find me later? She tastes the terror in her mouth again. She swallows. I am over 3 years old, corn silk blonde and blue-eyed like any Polish child. There is terrible suffering among the peasants, starvation, and like so many others, I am ill, perhaps dying. I have bad lungs, fever, an ugly ear infection that oozes pus, and none of these symptoms are disappearing. The night before, my mother feeds me watery soup and then sits and listens while I say my prayers to the Holy Mother, Mother of God. I ask her, just as the nuns taught me, to help us all, my mother, the old woman, and then catching myself learning to use memory, I ask the Mother of God to help my father. The Polish words slip easily from my lips. My mother is satisfied. The peasant has perhaps heard and is reassured. My mother has found her to be kind, but knows that she is suspicious of strangers. My mother is sick, goiter, malnutrition, vitamin deficiencies. She has skin sores which she cannot cure. For months now, she has been living in complete isolation with no point of reference outside of herself. She has been her own sole advisor, companion, comforter. Almost everyone of her world is dead. Three sisters, nephews and nieces, her mother, her husband, her in-laws, all gone. Even the remnants of the resistance, those few left after the uprising, have dispersed into the Polish countryside. She is more alone than she could have ever imagined. Only she knows her real name, and she is perhaps dying. She is 30 years old. I am over 3 years old. I have no consciousness of our danger, our separateness from the others. I have no awareness that we are playing a part. I only know that I have a special name, that I have been named for the goddess of peace. And each night I sleep secure in that knowledge. And when I wet my bed, my mother places me on her belly and lies on the stain. She fears the old woman and hopes her body's warmth will dry the sheet before dawn. My mother is walking down a road. Another woman joins her. My mother sees through the deception, but she has promised herself that never, under any circumstances, will she take that risk. So she swallows her hunger for contact and trust and instead talks about the sick child left behind and lies about the husband in the labor camp. Someone is walking towards them, a large, strange woman with wild red hair. They try not to look at her too closely to seem overly curious. But as they pass her, my mother feels something move inside her. The movement grows and grows till it is an explosion of yearning that she cannot contain. She stops, orders her companion to continue without her, and then she turns. The woman with the red hair has also stopped and turned. She is grotesque, bloated with hunger, almost savage in her rags. She and my mother move towards each other. Cautiously, deliberately, they probe past the hunger, the swollen flesh, the infected skin, the rags. Slowly, they begin to pierce 5 years of encrusted history. And slowly, there is perception and recognition. In the wilderness of occupied Poland, in this vast emptiness where no one can be trusted, my mother has suddenly, bizarrely, met one of my father's teachers, a family friend, another Jew. They do not cry, but weep as they chronicle the dead and count the living. Then they rush to me. To the woman, I'm a familiar sight. She calculates that I will not live out the week, but comments only on my striking resemblance to my father. She says she has contacts. She leaves. One night, a package of food is delivered anonymously. We eat. We begin to bridge the gap towards life. We survive. said. These words are dedicated to those who died. These words are dedicated to those who died because they had no love and felt alone in the world. Because they were afraid to be alone and tried to stick it out. Because they could not ask. Because they were shunned. Because they were sick and their bodies could not resist the disease. Because they played it safe. Because they had no connections. Because they had no faith. Because they felt they did not belong and wanted to die. These words are dedicated to those who died because they were loners and liked it, because they acquired friends and drew others to them, because they took risks, because they were stubborn and refused to give up, because they asked for too much. These words are dedicated to those who died because a card was lost and a number was skipped, because a bed was denied, because a place was filled and no other place was left. These words are dedicated to those who died because someone did not follow through, because someone was overworked and forgot, because someone left everything to God, because someone was late, because someone did not arrive at all, because someone told them to wait and they just couldn't any longer. These words are dedicated to those who died because death is a punishment, because death is a reward, because death is the final rest, because death is eternal rage. These words are dedicated to those who died. Bashert. These words are dedicated to those who survived. These words are dedicated to those who survived because their second grade teacher gave them books, because they did not draw attention to themselves and got lost in the shuffle, because they knew someone else who could help them and bumped into them on a corner on a Thursday afternoon, because they played it safe, because they were lucky. These words are dedicated to those who survived because they knew how to cut corners, because they drew attention to themselves and always got picked, because they took risks, because they had no principles and were hard. These words are dedicated to those who survived because they refused to give up and defied statistics, because they had faith and trusted in God, because they expected the worst and were always prepared, because they were angry, because they could ask, because they mooched off others and saved their strength, because they endured humiliation, because they turned the other cheek, because they looked the other way. These words are dedicated to those who survived because life is a wilderness and they were savage, because life is an awakening and they were alert, because life is a flowering and they blossomed, because life is a struggle and they struggled, because life is a gift and they were free to accept it. But these words are dedicated to those who survived. Bashert. Bashert.
The recording is
These words are dedicated to those who died.
No, they should get credit. Uwe and Gabi made the recording, so they deserve the credit.
We will talk about it later. Yeah.
I know very little. My father, I'm very connected to my father, though I didn't even know him. I had the fortune of being born, first of all, on his birthday. So we shared a birthday, April 17th. The Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, as some of you may or may not know, was on April 19th, and he was killed on the second day, which was April 20th. So he was killed basically after my second, on his 30th, 3 days after his 30th and my second birthday. And I saw him the last time probably about 6 months before that, so I really never knew him. So I was, my mother was kind of reluctant to talk about him, and I sort of picked up little bits and pieces about him, trying to construct who he was. And at one point, a number of years ago, I wrote a piece called About My Father, in which I sort of put in almost everything I knew about him. At the end, at this point, I'd actually know quite a bit more. But I always liked the poem because it sort of indicated where I was at that time. So I'd just like to read that. About My Father. He became a teetotaler out of his socialist convictions. During the war, he began to drink again. He was casual. He kept his tie in his pocket till the last minute before oral exams. He left me on the street to be picked up by the nuns from the orphanage. He watched me from a distant doorway. Once he refused to hit me, he told my mother his hand was too large. He wrote to his aunt that he hoped the baby would be a boy. When he was a student, Jews were not permitted to sit in the front rows of lecture halls. He made it a point to stand throughout the lectures. Ultimately, Jews were allowed to sit. He was a discus thrower. According to some, he got along with everyone, Jews, Goyim, children. He was caught a couple of times by the Germans. They thought he was a Polish smuggler. Once he was put on a train for Treblinka. He jumped, was shot at and wounded, but got back to Warsaw alive. He believed in resistance. This other poem also comes sort of from that same period. In 1983, my mother and I visited Poland for the first time. It was my mother's only visit back to Poland. It was the 40th anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, and we didn't come actually in April. We came in during the summer. And we went to the area that was the Umschlagplatz, except at the time in 83, there was no memorial of any sort. So this is the poem that I wrote about that experience of going there that year. I should add that this was, of course, when Solidarność was illegal, and there was a great deal of talk. And when we came was right after the Pope's visit here. And Warsaw was just filled with these beautiful altars all over the sidewalks with flowers to the Pope. And there was a hope that the Pope would negotiate some kind of an amnesty for political prisoners at the time. So the epigraph to this poem is from the Yiddish poet Haylevik. In Treblinka bin ich nicht gewesen. I was never in Treblinka. Warsaw, 1983, Umschlagplatz. No horrors this time. It's 1983, June, summer. Warsaw is tense, but over Solidarność, over amnesty. A small white brick wall, two plaques in Polish and Yiddish to the effect that from here, seinen sie gefahren, kein Treblinka. From here, they went to Treblinka. Two stubby candles on either side, neither burning. The guide lights one with a lighter. The wind blows it out. A gas station pumping gas right behind. A building on one side. Perhaps from that time, Efshar and Edis. Maybe it's all. And there are tracks, I think. I do not cry. What's to cry about? An ordinary street, people going about their business 40 years later, tense about amnesty. This street might have been my home. This street might have been the beginning of my journey to death. I must remember that it was neither. I live on another continent. It is 1983. I am now a visitor. History stops for no one.
It sounds like a new form of music. Is it on? Is it off? Is it on? It's okay. One of the things that I experimented with, is this on? Can you hear me?
No.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. They can't hear me. One of the things that I've tried to experiment with is how to use Yiddish in my English poetry, because I fought very, very hard to master English. It was my fourth language by the time I was 8, and I had sort of had enough with languages. So my battle was always with English, but at one point I became interested in possibly using my Yiddish, because I went to Yiddish shulas and middle shul, and I read Yiddish literature. I even did a postdoc in Yiddish, but I never really thought about incorporating it until a friend of mine sort of pushed me about it. So what I'm going to read you is one of these attempts to use Yiddish in my English poetry. It's called Etliche Welter auf Mama Loschen. Some of you know maybe that Mama Loschen, which literally means mother tongue, is synonymous with the word Yiddish. So if somebody says Chad Mama Loschen, it means I speak Yiddish. So this is everything you hear is translated, but you will notice that I will stop translating and that the Yiddish will take over the poem. Etliche Welter auf Mama Loschen, a few words in the mother tongue. Lemushel, for example, die Kurve, the whore, a woman who acknowledges her passions. Die Jidina, the Jewish woman, ignorant, overbearing. Let's face it, every woman is one. Die Jente, the gossip, the busybody who knows what's what and is never caught off guard. Die Lesbianke, the one with the roommate, though we never use the word. Das Weibel, the wife or the little woman. In der Heim, at home, where she does everything to keep Yiddishkeit alive. Yiddishkeit, a way of being Jewish, always arguable. In Mark, where she buys die Kartoffel und Challe, yes, potatoes and Challe, die Kartoffel, the material counterpart of Yiddishkeit. Mit Sibylis, with onions that bring Tränen zu die Augen, tears to her eyes when she sees how little it all is. Weniger und weniger, less and less. Die Challe, braided wie ihr Haar vor der Hasene, like her hair before the wedding when she was as a Shane Mädel, such a pretty girl. Die lange schwarze Haar, the long black hair. Die lange schwarze Haar. Afroi cholimt. A woman dreams ihr Ort auf der Welt, her place in this world. Und sie hat Meure, and she is afraid, so afraid of the words Kurve, Jidene, Jente, Lesbianke, Weibel. Sie cholimt, she dreams, und sie hat Meure, and she is afraid, ihr Ort, die Welt, die Heim, der Mark. A Mädel cholimt, a Kurve cholimt, a Jidene cholimt, a Jente cholimt, a Lesbianke cholimt, a Weibel cholimt, die Kartoffel, die Halle, Jiddischkeit, sie cholimt, die Haar, die lange schwarze Haar, sie cholimt, sie cholimt, sie cholimt. This poem is in the voice of a Yiddish writer named Fradl Stock. And one of the things that interested me about Fradl Stock is that she tried to navigate the distance between her native language, which was Mama Loschen Yiddish, and coming to America and having to deal with English. And she's one of the,
I practically only Yiddish writer I know that actually tried to write in English, not very successfully. She wrote a very, very long novel, which I'm sad to say was really terrible. And she was just much better in Yiddish. And this poem, I mean, she, when at the time that I wrote the poem, the only thing, one of the things that was known about her was that she had mental issues and she was in an institution and that she had died there. But very recently, Norma Faim Pratt, who's a feminist historian and critic, has discovered that, in fact, that wasn't true, that she actually left the institution and went on to California and died there. But in any case, this poem is really about the struggle to try to navigate two languages. And you'll see I'm trying to compare English and Yiddish, certain words in it. It's got an epigraph from someone you all know, Czesław Miłosz, and the epigraph is, "Language is the only homeland." And this is Fradl's voice, Fradl speaking. "They make it sound easy, some disjointed sentences, a few allusions to mankind. But for me, it was not so simple, more like trying to cover the distance from here to the corner or between two sounds. Think of it, hame and home, the meaning the same, of course, exactly, but the shift in vowel was the ocean in which I drowned. I tried. I did try, first held with Yiddish, but you know, it's hard. You write Gus, and street echoes back, no resonance. And let's face it, memory falters. You try to keep track of the difference, like Gott and God, or Hois and House, but they blur, and you start using alley when you mean Gessele or Avenue. When it's a boulevard. And before you know it, you're on some alien path, standing before a brick house, the door slightly familiar. Still, you can't place it exactly. Passers-by stop, concerned. They speak, but you've heard all of this before, the vowels shifting up and down, the subtle change in the guttural sounds, and now it's nothing more than babble. And so you accept it. You're lost. This time, you really don't know where you are. Land or sea, the house floats before you. Perhaps you once sat at that window and it was home and looked out on that street or Gessele. Perhaps it was a dead end. Perhaps a shortcut. Perhaps not. A movement by the door. They stand there, beckoning, mouths open, closed. Come in, come in. I understood it was a welcome. A dank, a dank, I said, till I heard the lock snap behind me.
One more?
Yes. Okay, maybe I end with this. I'm going to end with a poem about my mother. You've heard a little bit about her. My mother died a year ago this March, and she was almost 102. She died in March. July would have been her 102nd birthday. I wrote this at a time when she had just turned 99. And she had some dementia, and she couldn't totally respond to everything, and she was... I'm sure a lot of you have had this experience with elderly parents. She was confined to a wheelchair. She was frustrated. She had to stay in the apartment. Anyway, I'm going to end with this poem. My mother at 99. Her eyes tell me of her longing to escape her wheelchaired body. The mouth can only moan. Words have wandered off, locked up in a backroom closet. Lips pressed tightly, she groans, "Let me out, let me go home." She means that first home, the one with candles and no bath, the home of too few beds and hunger. But she insists, joy, with Bubba trying to keep peace. Hit me, she'd tell them, laughing, when things got out of hand and each had insisted on being the winner. I was her favorite, she once whispered with pride, and I wondered if I should believe her. Yes, there was a home where she returned late at night after a day's work of sewing and an evening class. She was just 12, small for her age, dreaming only of books, waiting to be read. She'd recite Pantadeusz silently to herself before falling asleep, her favorite. This apartment of 45 years that she so loved and so loved to show off, the balcony, the tree-filled views, is now an unmarked island on a world map. Packed bookshelves line all the rooms, filled with stories, many with her name, gifts and givers forgotten. If she could just escape this prison, abandon this useless body, and return to that first place, words would also return in gathering meaning. Even Mickiewicz himself would be there to proclaim in passionate, perfect verse that home is truly loved only after it is lost forever. She cannot admit this will not happen, that she's locked up for good, that there is no escape. And so she moans in her wheelchair, her eyes begging, let me go, let me go. Mama she, my eyes tell her, I am here, there is no key, but I promise, I will come again. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dziękuję bardzo.
Ja dziękuję.
Through these poems, listening to the poems, you could hear which direction Irena is taking us. And I have a lot of questions which would develop this information which you give us, the trace you give us in the poems. You talk about your father in one of the poems. I know that you are here since many days already in Warszawa and then in Kraków, and we will travel to Łódź and to Sejny.
To Lublin.
Yeah. And we call this travel Bashert. That's why you could hear this poem twice. And my question is, what do you think now about your father, what you could find, and how is changing image of him in your mind through the years you search?
That's a really hard question. Let me see. Can I just raise this a little bit? I think, you know, it's very hard. One of the hardest things, I think, is that there's practically, I have nothing of my father except a photograph of him at his gymnasium for his gymnasium graduation when he was about 18, and another photograph that his mother sent to his aunt in America when he was 8. And so that's really literally all I have physically of anything of his. And so it's been, the only thing I've been able to do is just sort of listen to what other people have said about him, which I put into the poem, the little that my mother told me. I was very, very lucky that somebody had the brilliant idea, even though I had been in Warszawa a number of times, to go to the Polytechnic where he studied, because he was I'm not even clear that he finished, but he was studying engineering at the time that the war broke out. And it turned out that there was a youth they held that survived the bombings and the destruction that happened at the university there. His file happened to survive. So it was this miraculous piece of documentation, this file which had even handwritten notes by him asking for stipends or asking for different permissions. So I found it. So, I mean, I think I've gotten a much more kind of regular person kind of image of him, whereas before he was completely associated with the uprising. I'm getting a picture of him before the war, you know, in sort of a more normal kind of circumstances. And that's something that's always been something that I've been trying to get. And it's become harder, of course, with that generation dying out. I mean, there's no more people that I can really ask about what he was like.
He was Bundist, yeah? He was, yes, Bundist. Can you say something about this?
Oh, my gosh, yes. He was an ardent Bundist, as am I. He was raised in the Bund. His parents were Bundists, the Jewish Labor Bund. He was very active. Like when I said he was a discus thrower, he was very active in Morgenstern, which was the Bund's sports organization. And he was, of course, in the Jewish resistance. He was one of the Bund representatives on Job, the Żydowska organizacja bohaterstwa, bojowa, Job. Yes, he was very politically active. He was very much. Very much rooted in Poland. He really wanted to live here. He was raised that way. He was raised in a very socialist Jewish labor home. Both his parents were activists. And he had an older sister, Gina Klepfisch, who also was very, very active.
But it influenced also your way of thinking, the Bundist ideology. Yeah?
Well, I was raised in, after we left Poland in 1946 and we went to Sweden for 3 years, and the people that I was with were all Jewish Labor Bundists. And I just absorbed it like a sponge. I mean, I never rebelled. I never wanted to be anything but, I just wanted to go back to interwar Poland. In my fantasy about Jewish life. Not that I was romantic about what that period was like, because it was a very difficult period. But what always attracted me to it was the energy and the dedication and the commitment to ideals that the Jewish Labor Bund represented for me. And I, when I was a kid in the United States, you know, I could not be happier than when my mother would take me to her friend's house, and I was the only child and I had nobody to play with, but I could just sit quietly and listen to them talk. I loved listening to them talk about their life before and during the war or whatever. And I totally absorbed it. I felt that it totally shaped my political view in the United States. It shaped my feminism. It shaped my gay rights activism. It shaped my Middle East activism around Israel. It's definitely sort of the rock of anything. Everything else sort of stems from there.
And there you could hear also Yiddish, because your first language was Polish, yeah, as a child.
My first language was Polish. I didn't hear Yiddish until right after the war when we were living in Lodz. And of course, I mean, during the war, we weren't speaking Yiddish. I mean, we were passing, so. And then when we moved to Sweden, everybody in the house spoke Yiddish. My mother persisted in speaking with me in Polish. I went to a Swedish school and learned Swedish. Nobody else spoke Swedish in the house except me. And we came to America, and my mother got a lot of pressure from friends. You know, there was, I'm not telling you anything new, there was a very strong reaction among some Jewish survivors against Poland and Polish. And a lot of people just, as a principle among her friends, said that they would not speak Polish anymore. and insisted on speaking Yiddish. My mother did not do that, and they were mad at her, in fact, for not speaking with me in Yiddish, for continuing to speak with me in Polish. I was actually grateful to her because I felt that it was one of the continuities. It was not for any ideological reasons, but I had sort of had it with languages. I mean, it was hard enough with Swedish, and now I was back in English, and now they wanted me to speak Yiddish. I mean, it was just too much. So, but she got a lot of flack for it. But my mother loved, she was a great reader. She loved Polish literature. She could, till the end of her life, she could recite Polish poetry. And she loved the language. She loved, she was very, she was the fifth child in a family of six children. And the older children, some of them went to folkschulas, you know, these folks, these Yiddish schools. When it was time for her to go to school, her older siblings were adamant with her mother that she should go to a Polish school because they felt it would give her some mobility. And it really, it was certainly not the only thing, but it was definitely, her Polish contributed a great deal to her ability to move on the Aryan side and to move among Poles because she spoke impeccably. I mean, it was very good. So I was always, I mean, I always spoke to her in Polish. My Polish is very limited. It's not, it's sort of a fifth grader. I mean, a fifth-year-old, sort of pre-kindergarten. And I bought a few books that I'm reading, children's books. I'm trying to learn how to read a little bit in Polish.
If you have some recommendations later for Irena about books which she can read in Polish. Yeah. I wanted just that you say your mother name as we bring her here with her name.
My mother, Ruska. Ruska, her name was originally Shoshana Ruska. Lodzia, her name during the war was Lodzia. A lot of people kept their Polish names after the war, and she, a lot of people called her, she was also called Mama Law, because Gaga couldn't say Lodzia, so he called her Mama Law. And she was Ruszke auf Yiddish, and she was Rose as an American.
Perchikov, yes?
Perchikov.
So maybe now you can tell us, I know some, there is a nice story about this, how you started to use Yiddish in your poetry, because it came later, yeah? First was English.
Yeah, definitely. I began, it was interesting because when I became, I got a job in California and sometime in the 80s to teach in a women's workshop. It was a creative writing workshop for 3 weeks in California in Santa Cruz. And I was rooming with one of the other teachers who was Gloria Anzaldúa. Gloria Anzaldúa was a Chicana gay lesbian writer, brilliant, just brilliant. She came from Texas originally. She was born there. She spoke with a heavy, heavy Spanish accent because that was her first language. She learned English very late. Her family had been in Texas for like 400 years, but she spoke with a heavy Spanish accent. And we roomed together, and we compared some notes. And of course, we were very different. I mean, she's a Chicana from Texas. I'm a Jew from Warsaw.
What means Chicana? Can you
Chicana, it's Mexican American roots, basically. And she wrote a lot of her material. She was a great writer and poet. She wrote a very famous book called Borderlands that everybody should read. But she wrote a lot, used Spanish a lot. And she sort of, one day was one of those regular moments where she said, she knew about my background. She said, how come you don't use Yiddish? You know, what's the story? And of course it was different because she had an audience that already spoke Spanish and knew Spanish and it's sort of... So I thought about it, and it was really her push that summer that created the whole idea. So it was funny. But you know, we had these things in common. We were both gay, and we were both in minority communities, and we were both having to deal with what it meant to be gay in a minority community, which was, put very succinctly, not much fun. And so it was Gloria's almost example and stuff. But I mean, for me, it was much more difficult in the sense that I didn't have a ready audience that would understand Yiddish. I mean, it wasn't a question of non-Jews not knowing Yiddish. It was a question of Jews not knowing Yiddish. So I didn't. Gloria had an audience in which a lot of them knew Spanish. So she could use Spanish in her writing in a way that was different, I think, than it was for me to use Yiddish.
When I was searching information about you long time ago, when I read Bashert and then I started to be interested, I found a quotation from you, I think from long time ago, and I would like that you say after I read it what you think, how you feel about it now. You said once, or you wrote once, "I am an outsider, I'm a lesbian, a shikse. The Jewish community is not my community, but as a Jew in Christian anti-Semitic society, the Jewish community is and will always remain my community, enemy and ally."
Ally.
Ally. I'm sorry, ally.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, it's very difficult to come out. I mean, it's very painful. I don't know how many people here have ever, I'm sure it's true here in Poland now. Everything's going backwards anyway, here, there, in the United States. I had a very difficult time coming out, and the Jewish community and the Yiddish community was a community that I just really loved and loved very deeply and was very committed to. And when I came out, I found out, gee, big surprise, they're homophobic, you know, and like everybody else. And that was very hard for me because on the one hand, I needed to come out. On the other hand, I didn't want to be alienated from them. And so it was a conflict. It was a terrible conflict for me. I mean, I didn't want to reject the community, but the community was rejecting me. So it took a while. I mean, I think things got straightened out. But I think a lot of us who came from minority communities experienced this. It was very painful. I was angry. At the same time, I have to say, I never, ever thought of rejecting it. I just had to figure out a way of how to deal with it. And eventually, I think, you know, things turned around. But it didn't just turn around in the Jewish community. It turned around in the country. And the Jewish community kind of followed. But it was very difficult. It was very difficult I came out in the 70s. It was a very hard time. It was not an easy time to be out.
Thank you for this answer. And you teach at the Barnard College.
Yeah.
And you meet their young American feminists. Can you tell me something about them? How they are?
Because
this times in Poland about feminism and gender starts to be very difficult. Our friend Bożena Kew, which is supposed to guide this meeting, she just, her study was cancelled because gender is treated slowly in Poland like a kind of, I don't know what. So how is it in USA?
Well, I don't know. I can only talk from my own experience. I don't know how to generalize, though. I have to say that anything I say about this is probably true up to last November, because I don't, you know, after the election, things are in such turmoil in the United States right now. On the whole, I mean, my students always puzzle me to a certain degree. They support a lot of what I would consider feminist causes. But they don't like the word feminist. I mean, they don't want to be labeled as feminist. They're afraid. My students are afraid of certain words. They're afraid of being called radical. I thought it was a privilege to be called radical. They think it's a stigma. They don't want to be called radical. And somehow they associate the word feminist with being radical, even though they support a lot of feminist issues. So I think that's one thing. I think the other thing is I think it's a failure of my generation, definitely of my generation, that for some, they seem to believe that the second wave of feminists really put down women who stayed at home and took care of children and decided to be housewives for whatever reason. They're defensive about that decision. And they don't want to be defensive about it. And they feel that the movement is somehow putting them down. Now,
I haven't really seen it, but I've heard this. I mean, I've heard my students complain about this in class when they open up, even about in Barnard about their other classes. They just feel that there's a stigma to being at home and being a mother and just making that kind of choice. And I think that also feeds into the whole issue of whether you want to label yourself a feminist or not, you know. So I think there's that. I do think that they've been living in a bubble in the sense that I think a lot of that younger generation thinks that whatever is going to be there forever, and they don't realize that these were hard-fought battles and it can be taken away. I think that some of them are beginning. I think this new administration is making people, younger women, realize it can be taken away. It's not there forever. Whatever your privileges are, whatever your rights are, they can be taken away. And I think that's going to be a very hard lesson. And hopefully that when that realization happens, real organizing will also result from that. But I think they have taken it for granted. I think, you know, what their mothers achieved or what the previous generation achieved, they thought was always going to be there. It's not.
So we come now to another woman word, which was in prison, where you used to teach. Can you tell us something about it?
Yeah, I think a country's prison system is a real reflection of what their justice system is. And I don't know what it's like here in Poland. I know in the United States it's a horror. It's just a horror. It's totally, I mean, to use the word unfair is like the mildest, I mean, it's really totally an understatement. It's just an unjust system. And the people in prison are very invisible. People don't really know who they are or why they're there or how they got there or what made them go there. I was always interested in it. I have a number of friends. There's a very big, I mean, I'm not a special person for doing this because there's a big movement in the United States, prison reform. There have been anthologies of prison writing. There's a lot of teaching going on. There's a lot of creative work that's going on in prison. But it's an invisible world, and it's a forgotten world. And I have to say that when I go to teach at Bedford, it was always extremely inspiring to see the struggle of these women to get an education, to try to get a college degree, and to know some of their stories. And this doesn't mean that I don't believe that people should be punished or what, but prisons do not really reform people. Sometimes they make them worse. And I think looking at it from a much more humane point of view, in the United States, the racial ratio, in other words, there's so many more African Americans and brown people and people of color in prison than whites. It's appalling. It's just appalling. And it's all unequal. It's not that the same crimes that white people commit, they don't end up there. So I think there's a lot to be done there. I mean, Obama was actually finally moving in the direction a little bit of reforming it, and now it's all, of course, going backwards. So it's very depressing. But I very much value the teaching experience at Bedford, and I encourage people to find out. I mean, don't be afraid of it. They're people with lots of very serious, often serious problems and serious crimes, but it's not anything to be afraid of. You should just go and meet them and do whatever you can to help them. Education is critical, critical. And one of the saddest things about people about education in prison is I went in June, they have a graduation, and when they have graduation, they allow the families of the women to come. So you have these kids, you have their children there, and you have their parents there, and it's just extremely moving. They all go up, the children go up, and the parents go up on the stage when they get their diploma. And it's really very, very joyful, but it's also a heartbreaker because they're in prison and they're not getting out.
Last question, because I would like that you have opportunity to ask questions. I see some Yiddishes and friends here between you. So you was born in the ghetto 1941, and you went through different changes in your life. What can you say for us? How we should live now, because the time is strange.
What do you mean?
How we, I don't know, what, maybe you have some message for us, or
I
maybe...
I don't have any messages for anybody.
Okay, this is also a message. This is also a message, because, you know, in your poem, Bashert, because of which we meet here together, I tell you, I met Irena because of this poem. I found poem in the internet, and then it happened, and thanks to Marsha Gildin, which is here on the among you, and all other friends, and Uwe, and all other people which helped us, we could travel here to Poland, and Irena could come. So in this poem, what is touching me so much at the end, you say, I will quote one sentence. These words are dedicated to those who survived, because life is a gift, and they were free to accept it.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think you can't, I do think it's a gift. I think you have to, and I think you have to be free. I think that part of it partly came from my sense about prison and stuff. You have to be free in order to accept the gifts.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Dziękuję bardzo. Bardzo dziękuję.